If it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up, then I think just maybe I'd sing another love song for you, baby. If it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up and I feel so blue, I'd sing another love song just for you. If it wasn't for the fact that our current foreign minister
called Bill
has built a fortune off of genocide, and if it wasn't for the fact that everything is lies
and that the blind lead the blind towards the finish line,
maybe I wouldn't be so worried about the fact that there's no indignation
in the nation,
no protests against a grotesque situation.
Only thing people complain about is immigration.
Only thing I'm thinking about is the time I'm wasting. I should be writing rhymes about how amazing you look
and your touch
and your smile
and your feel.
Maybe I'll do it tomorrow.
Maybe I would do it tomorrow. If the world seems brighter than today. Yeah, maybe I would do it tomorrow. But until then, I stay.
If it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up, then I think just maybe I'd sing another love song for you, baby. Baby. If it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up and I feel so blue, I'd sing another love song just for you.
If it wasn't for our daughter getting fed up already with a different set of rules for the boys in the class, and your girl telling us that last year was heavy,
right.
Never got that many death threats in the past. She's a Muslim in the media, a woman with a voice. We are crippled by hate, leaving the youth with no choice but to riot in frustration. Who listens to the poor unless they shoot up the police station, calling out for war
and still get the blame in the end? If it wasn't for next election, I'd sing for you again.
But with Nazis round the corner, gunshots on our street, we both awake at night losing our sleep, and I know you feel the same way. Working for more than just a payday, you go get 'em. I'm proud of you, my love, my best friend. We back at it again. All I can say,
if it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up, then I think just maybe I'd sing another love song for you, baby. If it wasn't for the fact that the world's fucked up and I feel so blue, I sing another love song just for you.
All right, once again, the It's Going Down podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we are joined with a very special guest once again. We had them on the program already a couple months back. You might have remembered it is James, longtime anti-fascist and anarchist thinker, writer, and organizer. Today, he's going to be talking about the first months of the Trump regime, adding some analysis on what they're doing, how people are fighting back, how the far right and the so-called alt-right are responding to the Trump regime. He's also promoting an upcoming tour he's going to be taking part in, entitled The Front Lines Are Everywhere, which is talking about and organizing against the grand juries at Standing Rock, also all the repression that we have going on across the country from Washington, D.C., the over 200 people been arrested on January 20th, the people facing charges in Sacramento for shutting down the so-called Traditionalist Worker Party. For everybody out there that's standing up and fighting back and facing massive felony charges, James is going to be talking today about adding some analysis to that repression, thinking about it, how we can build up strong, robust self-defense as a movement against it, and how we should be moving forward. So thanks a lot for James for coming on. And remember, on April 1st to 7th, there is a call for a week of solidarity against repression, against all this stuff that they're leveling at us, to really get out and tell the public that we're not professional protesters. We're not here to kill everybody. We're here to set them free. We're here to get crazy in the streets, and we want you to join us. So please, thank you for tuning into It's Going Down, itsgoingdown.org. If you can, please go on our website, sign up to become a monthly sustainer, sign up to get on our newsletter that comes out once or twice every month. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get to it. So we're joined here today with James. James is on the program right when Trump was selected by the Electoral College. And James, let's just get into it. I mean, since we did that first recording, now it's been about 4 months now.
5 months, 4 months? It's been several months. Several months has passed. You know, the months are fake, but the numbers are real. So several months have passed. In your mind, what has changed since we have done that recording as far as your analysis of the situation? How has reality compared with what you thought going into the Trump administration? What are your thoughts right now?
Well, the one thing that we can say is that nothing has gotten better necessarily. You know, I think for a while there was a lot of fantasies on various parts of the left that, you know, the Electoral College would revolt or the CIA would, you know, intervene or, you know, some magical force would prevent this from taking place. And, you know, clearly that hasn't come to pass. And I think, you know, I think those fantasies were sort of based on a sense of desperation and lack of any plan or strategy for how to respond ourselves. You know, Trump was inaugurated amidst, you know, fairly small inauguration crowd, at least on the pro-Trump side, pretty substantial protests against him. And, you know, he's had a difficult time consolidating power, but he also, you know, hasn't run into any real significant roadblocks. Most of his cabinet appointees have all been confirmed by Congress. You know, he's put forward a number of executive orders towards advancing his campaign promises around immigration, around, you know, support for law enforcement, cracking down on dissent, things of that sort. And, you know, there's been some struggles over all of this. You know, his national security advisor had to resign amid controversy over his communications with Russia. The first sort of so-called immigrant ban or Muslim ban was struck down by federal courts. We've seen a second one that he's put in place since then that has been to much less controversy and fanfare. Despite, you know, fairly modest substantive changes, the thrust of it is still the same. And yet we don't see the outrage that people had, you know, just a few weeks ago. And, you know, we've also seen, you know, sort of a continuing slow burn, or slow growth from the grassroots far right. They've had a series of, you know, pro-Trump rallies. It's, you know, sort of strains the memory to think of a time when people were, you know, having to organize rallies in support of a newly sitting president. Usually that's a time of you know, great power, great credibility for the incoming president. And, you know, his supporters are usually pretty content to rest on the fact that, you know, he occupies that position. And now we're, you know, in a situation where, you know, the Trump supporters in the country feel so under siege and so somewhat demoralized in the sense that they're having to organize rallies to, you know, produce some show of support for the Trump regime. And, you know, a lot of those rallies have been, you know, pretty lackluster. There was a lot of them that, you know, numbered in the 100 to 200s, you know, a few larger ones in some cities, but, you know, nothing on the scale of what happened around the inauguration across the country in terms of anti-Trump protests, nothing on the scale of what happened at airports when the first Muslim ban went into effect. So I think, you know, the grassroots right is struggling in some regards, but also, you know, they're sort of in uncharted waters in some way.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about all of this. This is I'm really glad you brought it up. We're going to talk about the March for Trump. I'd like to ask you about Steve Bannon's 3-point plan that he laid out at CPAC. We're going to talk about that. But let's switch gears real quick and let's talk about repression. On January 20th, There was over 200 people that were arrested, and some of them are facing up to 10 years in prison for felony rioting charges. Many people have said that we should view this as a warning to what's to come. How do you see these arrests, and what does this level of repression say about what's on the horizon?
I mean, I definitely think it's both, you know, a sign of things to come, and also in some ways also just a continuation of what we've seen previously. Because there's sort of two ways to look at it. You know, the police that were on the streets in D.C. on J20, the police leadership, the prosecutors that are prosecuting the case, these are all the same people that have been there, that were there on January 19th also, under Obama's administration. And this is, you know, the police and prosecutors in, you know, a notoriously liberal Democratic city. And so in some ways you can see this as sort of a continuation. A lot of the tactics that they used were, you know, straight out of the playbook from 15 years ago during the anti-globalization movement, where you, you know, kettle a bunch of people somewhat indiscriminately and arrest all of them. But there's then also the part of it that's rather unprecedented. You know, the fact that everybody, you know, normally when people get mass arrested like that, they're getting charged with some minor infraction, you know, obstructing a highway or, you know, unlawful assembly or failure to disperse. And now they're being charged with felony rioting. And on top of that, you know, the charges almost 2 months past that, and most of the charges haven't been dropped or downgraded. There were a few people, primarily media, as well as a couple folks from the legal team that had charges dropped pretty quickly. But by no means all the media or all the, you know, legal observers that were arrested, certainly none of the people that, you know, didn't have the, you know, any sort of credential, none of them have had their charges dropped, to my knowledge. And so, that's somewhat, unprecedented in terms of protest policing. The other aspect was sort of the deep dive intelligence that's going on in terms of confiscating everybody's cell phones, subpoenaing social media accounts, both for protesters as well as, at least in a couple cases, the partners or associates of protesters. You know, obtaining search warrants to search the cell phones that they seized, things of that nature. And so, you know, in the past, you know, we've seen maybe trumped up charges and overzealous prosecution, but just the mass sort of targeted data mining that's going on with regard to these protests is somewhat unique. I can't recall a time that we've really seen that in regard to policing of protests in recent history. And then sort of seeing how that's rippled to other places. I know several weeks after the J20 protests, there were some protests in Philadelphia where some people got arrested, and at least a handful of those people also got charged with felony riot offenses. And so, which again was sort of unprecedented for protest policing in Philly, at least in recent history. And so what you can sort of glean there is that other police departments are taking notice of what happened in D.C. on J20 and, you know, sort of updating their playbook. Trump ran a significant portion of his campaign on, you know, returning respect for law and order, bringing back, you know, respect and obedience for law enforcement. And, you know, he's taken several actions since then to reinforce that. His executive order about, you know, this is going to be law and order, we're going to you know, respect our law enforcement. Attorney General Sessions has said that, you know, they're going to sort of pull back from The Department of Justice is going to pull back from their police oversight function. It's not clear that they're going to continue monitoring the police departments that were under consent decrees or under previous investigations. And so, you know, police all over the country are sort of getting this signal from on high that, you know, the chains are off, the watchdog's been put away, go to town. And then sort of couple this with you know, Trump's statements over the past year and a half about, you know, his attitude towards dissent and towards protesters. You know, it was close to a year ago, maybe even more than a year ago, that, you know, Trump was saying at a campaign rally that he yearned for the days when protesters would get carried out in ambulances. And now he's tweeting about protesters being, you know, paid protesters and professional anarchists, sort of tapping into this far-right conspiracy theory to paint dissent and protest as illegitimate. And so that's sort of the clouds on the horizon. And I think the sort of scary thing, the thing that scares me most about this is that it's not, in some ways, it's not quantitatively different or qualitatively different than what we've seen before. It's not, you know, jackbooted thugs running around kicking in houses, dragging people out in the street, and, you know, the sort of dramatics that we think of when we think of dictatorship or authoritarian regime. It's all running through the established channels, the infrastructure, the repressive infrastructure that's been, you know, set up and emboldened over the past 30 years. And, you know, from presidents on both sides of the Democratic-Republican divide. And so in some ways, it's all, you know, discomfortingly normal. And I think that's almost one of our biggest obstacles is increased repression that looks remarkably normal, because that's not going to draw a lot of attention from the people that aren't, you know, consciously paying attention. But it does pose pretty significant threats to our movements.
Just several days ago, we learned that over 106 people, the CHP, the California Highway Patrol in California, is pushing the DA to indict with everything from misdemeanor to felony charges for participating in the anti-fascist rally and shutdown of the Traditionalist Worker Party in Sacramento of June of last year. What do you think this – do you think this plays into a lot of the same things you were talking about? I mean, because the police are handing over hours and hours of evidence and video, and it seems like they got most of their information from social media – any thoughts on this? What does this say that 106 people the police are looking to charge? That doesn't mean that 106 people will be charged, but they certainly have cast a very wide net.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, it goes back to the sort of paradox that, like, this is both, you know, normal and extremely not normal. We've seen, you know, in recent protests that, you know, police spend weeks, sometimes even a couple months after the protest, poring over surveillance footage, you know, photos, things that people post on social media, trying to identify people after the fact to make arrests. We saw that in Minneapolis, St. Paul in 2008 after the Republican convention there, that the local law enforcement spent, you know, at least a month, maybe even longer, you know, trying to figure out who broke X window or, you know, who slashed X tire. And, you know, we saw a handful of arrests come out of that. But then the way that this is unprecedented is, one, it's, you know, we're looking at 8 months after the protest took place, which is a pretty considerable amount of time. And then the other thing is just the vast sweep of it that, you know, spending 6 months investigating, you know, a whole bunch of misdemeanor offenses is sort of preposterous. And, you know, it's aimed squarely at making a statement and making an example out of people. I think the other aspect of it is that, you know, there's really very little police repression that took place at the protest. The police were sort of caught flat-footed, and, you know, there's sort of the speculation as to whether or not they were just totally caught off guard or whether they were consciously not doing anything, whether they had some, you know, purpose. Maybe it was their idea going in that, you know, we'll let this conflict escalate as much as possible, and then, you know, we'll do the intelligence and prosecution and arrest after the fact instead of trying to intervene in that moment. Or, you know, maybe it was just that they were taking a hands-off approach to it, and when it escalated far beyond their expectations, and they were, you know, somewhat embarrassed in the public eye about, you know, how you let a street brawl with multiple, you know, almost deadly stabbings take place without really doing anything to intervene, then they had to do something at some point to cover their asses in that regard. It does raise questions about, you know, where is it that they're getting all their intelligence? You know, from the videos that I saw on the internet, you know, it was pretty difficult to tell, you know, who was doing what in any of those videos, even being able to identify, you know, whether this person doing this thing is a fascist or an anti-fascist was, you know, difficult for me, even when I, you know, in some ways know what I'm looking for.
Right.
And, you know, if they are just trolling, you know, social media or, you know, subpoenaing phone records to see, you know, whose cell phone dinged off of this tower at this time of day, so we know they were probably at the protests, and so, you know, we'll just say that they were involved in this, you know, general melee, and, you know, charge them and, you know, let the courts sort it out after, you know, we've sucked up all of their resources and doing legal defense and such. And so there's, you know, a dozen different ways that you can slice each scenario, but it does, you know, I think the biggest thing is that it signals a lot of fear and a lot of paranoia at people. And mm-hmm. I think it, you know, it tells the general public that, you know, if you go to these protests, if you go to these actions, you know, we're coming for you, we're watching, we've got a hammer that we're going to drop on you. And, you know, it might not be that day, might not be that week, it might be 8 months later. And so I think, you know, I think the biggest effect and biggest purpose of it is sort of signaling to people to just stay home, just shut up, just fall in line. And I think that's sort of the biggest reaction that we have to inoculate ourselves against.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to go to something knowing that, you know, something might happen. You might be, you know, attacked by a fascist. You know, the police might beat you up. Some crazy liberal might scream at you. You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen. But I mean, it's another thing to think about, well, shit, like 8 months from now, like, you know, because I brought my phone with me. And I really encourage people. There was several articles that were published on It's Going Down called Your Phone is a Cop. Basically, it argues if you have a smartphone, do not bring it to a protest. Don't bring it to a demonstration. Leave it at home. Get a burner phone if you need to contact people. But do not bring your phone because it will track your movements. It will be used against you. The police have technology now. They can suck up your information if they have something like Stingray. But definitely don't bring your phone out if you're going to a demonstration or a protest.
Right. And, you know, it sort of creates a conundrum for people, and especially people that are sort of, you know, looking to get involved in something for the first time, that, like, mm-hmm. you know, that's, you know, phones are how we run our lives now, you know, and that's the only way we know how to get in touch with people. You know, it's, people do everything on their phones. And so telling people to leave their phones at home is, you know, one of those, you know, one more obstacles to, you know, getting involved, participating in the resistance. And so I think we need to find workarounds for that, so that people, people know that they have a way to get in touch with somebody in an emergency, that they the people there will have their back if they're having a problem. We need to build build organization and movement around the idea that, you know, people are letting go of the one thing that makes them feel safe, connected, and in touch to come to this protest. And what are we going to replace that with?
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about the main drive for these large scale kind of blanketing arrests and charges is to really demoralize people, suck up their resources, and really put the fires out. That's what you're saying it's doing.
I mean, I think that's definitely a big part of it. The prospect of felony charges for, you know, participating in a protest, like, you know, it's hard to know going into a protest whether or not some random window is going to get broken, and whether or not, you know, because that window got broken, whether, you know, the entire crowd that you're with is going to get swept up and charged with felony charges. And so, and you know, dealing with this from a legal standpoint and as a movement, you know, is incredibly time consuming, incredibly energy consuming. You know, all the thousands of dollars that go into travel fees and legal expenses for people to fight their cases, you know, the prospect that some people might be going to prison for this, you know, just the stress that it puts on people, the time and stress that it puts on people involved, you know, that's, you know, just to take DC as an example, that's 230 people that are now spending the bulk of their time and energy fighting a legal case in Washington, D.C., instead of, you know, helping to attract new participants, helping to build a new campaign against the next thing that Trump is doing, helping, you know, spread the skills that we need to be spreading to people and such. And so, you know, it's a fear thing. It's a time suck thing. And it, you know, frankly, if we keep seeing prosecutions like that from every protest that takes place, that's, you know, anything more than just walking on the sidewalk peaceably and obediently, that's going to have some pretty drastic repercussions for the movement as a whole.
Right. Well, looking at Sacramento, though, I think, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, it seems like it's coming down the pipe, but I mean, it still seems like there is an opportunity to have a conversation about, why is it that the police are singling out the anti-fascists when we know that the Nazis are the ones that did the stabbing? So I think the question is, you know, how do we have a conversation about, like, when we live in a country where a mosque is burned down almost every week, where synagogues are getting vandalized all the time, where it seems like we can't go by a day without hearing about some crazy Trump supporter shooting and killing somebody, why is it the state is making it a very clear and pointed move to, you know, crack down on a movement that is fighting these things? And also at a time where Trump has said that, you know, look, we're not going to put federal funds towards going after the white supremacist movement. You know, we don't consider them a threat.
I mean, in some ways, it's fairly obvious that, you know, people that are fighting for white supremacy in a system that's white supremacist are always going to get more leeway than people that are fighting against that system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at various times, the state has taken a harder focus on various right-wing elements, various fascist elements. But I think we're in a moment where, you know, I think there's been a lot of, you know, somewhat tacit wink and nod support from Trump for those elements. You know, just the fact that Steve Bannon is the chief of staff and, you know, self-described, you know, spokesperson or outlet for the alt-right when he was CEO of Breitbart, you know, that's signaling to, you know, everybody in the country, law enforcement nationwide, that, you know, these are people that the regime supports. In the same way that they signal that, you know, our movements are, you know, targets for repression, you know, they signal in other ways that, you know, other movements are not. And I think, you know, To be fair, we also need to sort of avoid the impulse to sort of jump to conclusions. To my knowledge, I don't know if we have any information about exactly who they're recommending for charges out of the Sacramento situation. And so, you know, it is possible that there are charges that they're recommending against, you know, both sides. But also we know that, you know, certain people and that are in certain positions in society get, you know, more deference from the legal system than other people. Taking self-defense as one example, you know, police get a whole lot of deference when it comes to self-defense that ordinary people don't get. White people using self-defense against people of color get, you know, extraordinary deference from the legal system, from juries. That, you know, people of color don't enjoy when they're in a, you know, similar position. And so I think, you know, that gets to sort of the structural biases and the structural oppressions of the system as a whole, as to, you know, when there's this fight between fascists and anti-fascists, you know, what use of force is the state and the legal system going to consider as, you know, legitimate self-defense type force versus what is illegitimate, unprovoked, aggressive force. And so, you know, in some ways it's almost beside the point to much of the legal system that it was actually, you know, anti-fascists that were all stabbed. And, you know, fascists that were doing the stabbing and, you know, dropping guns on the ground after the fact and everything. And so, you know, that's sort of the double standard that we have to deal with in this society.
Well, you're about to go on a tour that's going to be talking about repression at Standing Rock in regards to the grand jury and just repression in general that's happening in this period. You know, what are you going to say to people when they ask, like, what should we do about this? You know, what does it mean to build robust movements that at their core have an ethics of self-defense? What are you going to tell people?
You know, one of the things I've been saying for a while now is that our movements need a more proactive approach to anti-repression work and, you know, legal defense work. A lot of times our, you know, legal support anti-repression strategies are sort of put together piecemeal in moments of panic when the state is actually coming for us. And that's sort of a bad time to, you know, build solid relationships, you know, create new organizations, things of that sort. Crisis is always, you know, a bad time to be putting anything together. And so I think we need to be, you know, thinking about these issues and planning for it in advance. You know, the whole of human of U.S. history tells us that you know, dissent, resistance, any organizing to change the status quo against oppression, against colonialism, is met with political repression from the state. And, you know, the degree, the type of repression that we see fluctuates over time based on the context. But we know that if we're fighting for a better world, that, you know, the state is going to try and stamp that out. And so with that knowledge, you know, what can we do in our organizing, in our organizations, in our communities, in our networks, to build resiliency ahead of time so that when, you know, when that hammer does fall, we're in a better position to stand up to it, to support people that are standing up to it, that we have resources and networks in place, to help us do that work. And, you know, thinking about this ahead of time and planning for this ahead of time, so that we're not sort of forced into a reactive posture by the state, so that we can, you know, respond deliberately and strategically instead of sort of in a knee-jerk crisis mode kind of way. And so I think I think when thinking about self-defense, movement self-defense, I think it's a whole lot about sort of understanding the history of what the state has done to us in the past, what the sort of trends are in regard to state repression, and then, you know, what we can do as a movement ahead of time to protect ourselves and to protect each other, and, you know, to create sort of a culture of, you know, nurturing resistance and standing up to the repression instead of, you know, unfortunately what's happened a lot in the past is that it, you know, really burns people out and uses up movements in fairly detrimental ways.
Well, what would you say those things could be? Because, I mean, as you said, it seems like the state is not necessarily like saying, like, you know, we will stop every single action from happening before it happens. But their thing seems to be like, yeah, 8 months from now, we're gonna call everybody into that courtroom that even thought about going to that thing, you know? So what kind of strategies in place do you think that we should be thinking about to stop that from happening?
I mean, I think there's a couple things that come to mind. One is, you know, talking to the people around us about the issues of repression, and sort of trying to build a higher baseline understanding of, you know, what repression is and how it works on movements and why, you know, why this is something we need to fight against. I think one of the biggest obstacles that some people deal with when, you know, they get targeted by the state is sort of the fear and the shame around it, and feeling like maybe if they keep it a secret or, you know, just withdraw from activism and not wanting to tell people because they don't want to feel like they're, you know, a danger to the movement because they're being targeted right then. I think that shame and that stigma is really, really damaging. And I think, you know, promoting an understanding ahead of time that, you know, repression is a part of, you know, this work of resistance, and that, you know, there's nothing shameful about, you know, the fact that the FBI or whoever is looking into you, that, you know, the fact that the FBI is looking into doesn't mean that you can no longer participate in the movement, things of that sort. And, you know, letting people know that, you know, that we have their backs, when this shit happens, and really, really signaling, in a concerted way that the people that are targeted with this repression that will be supported, obviously provided that they don't end up being cooperators or collaborators or informants of some sort, but that, you know, we have ways of supporting our people. I think another piece is building redundancy in our organizations, you know, thinking about, you know, if there's one person that's in charge of paying all the rent and bills and, you know, whatever for such and such community space or something, and, you know, having a plan in place for, you know, if that person gets arrested unexpectedly, so that, you know, community space doesn't, you know, spiral into crisis because the person that, you know, knows how to do all the financial stuff to keep it open is, you know, suddenly in prison. You know, making sure that we have, you know, legal support set up for every protest that we do, that there's a legal line that's being staffed by people that know what they're doing, that we've developed relationships with lawyers that can be on call, things of that sort, that, you know, people know whether or not, you know, you're going to a protest and know whether you're going to, you know when you're going to be checking in, so that if you don't check in, they can, you know, feed your cat and call your workplace or whatever. All the things that people need to feel supported in, you know, in the event of an arrest. I think, you know, being a lot more intentional about cultivating a larger movement culture of non-cooperation, I think is important. I think, you know, people that have been around for a while, it's easy to sort of take it for granted that you don't talk to law enforcement, that you don't cooperate. And I think, you know, that's something that we have to affirmatively build and affirmatively teach people and reteach people, because, you know, it's something that sort of goes against a lot of the common sense that many of us grow up with in terms of cooperating with law enforcement and authority. And so I think we have to be really intentional about building that culture. And so it's not the moment when the FBI is coming around that we have to convince somebody to not talk to them or something of that sort. You know, at that point, we're sort of pretty far behind the curve if that's the first time we're having that conversation. I think, you know, building stronger coalitions between, you know, diverse groups, diverse communities, the larger our support base across the larger population is, you know, the safer our movement is. And it's not, you know, building the resistance isn't just about, you know, being more proficient at certain tactics or, you know, necessarily having a bigger protest, but having, you know, a larger support base that, you know, when we're in sort of a crunch situation, that there's people there that will be outraged about it and that will have our backs. And, you know, that's sort of work that takes a lot of time in terms of, you know, starting conversations with people, you know, building relationships that are consistent, that are based on trust and good communication, things of that sort. And then I think the other piece of it, the final piece of it, is just sort of inoculating ourselves from the fear of the, you know, repressive tactics generally spread in our movements, and creating space to process that with people. One of the things I've often said is that repression is a form of abuse. And so we need to be able to, you know, create space to deal with that. You know, a lot of people, you know, end up with, you know, varying degrees of post-traumatic stress. You know, depending on the type of repression or, you know, people's background, it could, you know, be triggering other trauma that people have experienced in their lives. And so, you know, people need a space to rest, a space to heal, a space to process. And we have to be there to, you know, take care of each other and help each other through that.
Well, thanks for that. That's really good advice. Let's switch gears a little bit. You know, at CPAC, Steve Bannon kind of laid out a three-point program of the deconstruction of the administrative state, which is a fancy way of saying they're going to go after the welfare state. They want to promote this policy of economic nationalism, which is, you know, basically their way of, as they see it, attacking neoliberal globalized trade and, you know, switching to like bilateral trade agreements and, you know, that promote the supremacy of the American economy on a global scale. And also, you know, really solidifying national sovereignty in the way of building a wall along the border, the Muslim ban, banning refugees, and also aggressively deporting potentially millions of people. So I'm just curious, you know, when we talked a couple months ago, there was still the question of, you know, will Trump do these things? And obviously now the regime has shown its true colors. And I'm curious what you think about not necessarily Trump himself, but the people kind of behind Trump kind of really directing policy, and just what this has shown us about the moment. Like, you know, what are your initial thoughts in just seeing this play out the first couple of months?
I mean, it's all very insidious. From, you know, the day or two after Trump was elected, I think it became fairly apparent that, you know, Steve Bannon would be calling a lot more shots than Donald Trump is. And I think we've seen that pretty consistently. You know, just the fact that, you know, Bannon was the principal writer of the inauguration speech, I think there's, you know, pretty good argument that he wrote a lot of Trump's speech to Congress the other night. Has authored a number of these executive orders that Trump has signed. And there's, you know, Bannon's not the only sort of person from this political movement in the regime that, you know, Customs and Border Patrol is run by, you know, another, another sort of hardline right winger with, you know, some fascistic tendencies. I think, you know, Trump has filled a lot of his cabinet positions with sort of what you could call sort of corporate stooges that seem mostly intent on making money for whatever industry they represent or carrying out whatever, you know, ideological deconstruction they support, whether it's, you know, destroying public education or the EPA or whatever. But what's been somewhat telling is that a lot of the appointments in positions regarding the security apparatus have been people that I think are a lot more sort of fiercely loyal to Trump and also to Bannon. I don't think Steve Bannon really gave a shit who got appointed to Secretary of Education. But I think, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, he's real happy with Jeff Sessions at the Attorney General's office. And, you know, he was real happy with Michael Flynn on the National Security Council until, you know, Flynn got pushed out. And, you know, the fact that I can't remember the name, I think it was Harwood, the person that was originally mentioned as being Michael Flynn's replacement on the National Security Council, was basically turned down the position because it was made clear to him that he was not going to have any autonomy in that position, and that, you know, dissent in that position from the regime, the line that the regime is towing, was not something that was going to be tolerated. And so it was pretty clear that, you know, they're stacking the security apparatus with, you know, hardline loyalists. I think that's somewhat, you know, crucial to them trying, you know, being able to consolidate power. And I think, you know, sort of regarding Bannon's sort of, you know, larger vision, like, I don't know what their actual sort of understanding of the economy is, but I think it's fairly delusional to think that they're going to, you know, recreate U.S. manufacturing jobs, U.S. industry, without either some sort of really devastating trade war, or other, you know, extremely coercive mechanisms, you know, bullying companies into keeping jobs here. But what they can do is, you know, hire every unemployed steel mill worker, every unemployed auto worker, every unemployed longshoreman into the security apparatus. You know, they're talking about hiring 10 to 15,000 new Customs and Border Patrol agents. Who knows how many, you know, police officers are going to get hired, how many, you know, prison guards or, you know, detention center guards are going to be hired. And so I think, you know, that seems to be their vision for job growth. Everybody that's shut out of all the other sectors of the economy get their, you know, working middle class job in the security apparatus, holding everybody else in line.
But I mean, I think at the heart of it, that's kind of where there's some wiggle room with people, because the people that are concerned about jobs that, you know, could have, you know, that were, you know, not that into politics, quote unquote, that could have gone either way really for anybody, that just wanted things to change because everything sucks. I think those people really are the ones that could be potentially swayed against Trump. I mean, the people that are really just concerned about, you know, reestablishing the sanctity of, you know, the citizen or whiteness. I mean, I don't have much hope for those people. But, I mean, the people that are really thinking that Trump is going to, you know, quote, bring the jobs back, I mean, I just wonder when that veil is going to be lifted. I mean, when will people start to really be like, you know what, I don't think he's going to do it. Or like you said, if he does, it's going to be these really kind of like one-off things where like 500 jobs are saved here. Meanwhile, at GM, like over 1,000 people are laid off while the CEO of GM is in the Trump administration. Or, you know, they announced that they're hiring, you know, tens of thousands of new Border Patrol agents. I don't see how that's going to help anybody that lives in, you know, Appalachia or anything. But I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about, like, when do you think that will start to break down for people, that kind of, like, solidarity with Trump over this thing about jobs? And do you think that what should we do to help that kind of that legitimacy or that hope break down?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that. On a bad day, I would guess that that realization will happen, you know, possibly too late for the rest of us, and probably too late for them also. On the other hand, you know, people aren't stupid, and at a certain point, you know, if there's not a change in people's material circumstances, then, you know, that faith can be easily lost. So, I don't know. I think, you know, there's also the debate about, you know, how many people actually, you know, were voting for Trump just because of the job thing. Versus how much had sort of a deep-seated and maybe subconscious belief in the, you know, reinforcement of white supremacy in America. And, you know, at the very least, all those people were quite tolerant of it, that, you know, if bringing jobs back meant mass deportations and, you know, a racial war against certain segments of the population, you know, these people weren't particularly bothered by that. But, you know, taking it at face value, you know, maybe some of those people, you know, can be swung around. You know, I still think about the numbers, the polling numbers, you know, last May when, you know, it showed that Bernie Sanders sort of grossly outperformed Hillary Clinton in a head-to-head national race against Donald Trump, and what, you know, what the possibilities for that are. And so I think, you know, there is room for a populism that takes a different path with regard to, you know, a lot of these other issues and articulates a more humane vision of the world. So I don't think it's entirely hopeless, but I also don't have a grand strategy for how to capitalize on that.
I just don't see it. I mean, I see more and more people potentially. I mean, just like when Obama was elected, there was this massive hope, and I mean, it didn't really spring from, you know, anything he had done. I mean, it was just based on the fact that, like, you know, Bush had sucked so hard. And like, as Mumia said, you know, the president fucked up when they go and elect a black guy. But just this hope that, that, you know, things were going to be different because we had a young, hip, kind of, you know, nice talking, African-American guy with a, you know, nice looking family in the White House, that things were going to suddenly change. And, you know, that kind of, it took a while for it to break down, but I feel like at the end, like, it really did. And our people just felt like, well, yeah, that's just the way the government is. It's just this, like, faceless bureaucracy and, like, whatever. We're fighting for ourselves down here, you know. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit. You brought up numbers. You brought up support for Trump. What are your thoughts about this March for Trump thing that happened? What does it say that, you know, the numbers were not that large? You know, there's a popular meme with David Cross going around where he's like in a in a courtyard, and he said, "There are dozens of us here, dozens." And definitely, you know, some of these rallies were small. Some of them were, you know, fairly large, like maybe 500 people. But I didn't see anything where it was like tens of thousands of people. Obviously, I didn't even see anything where it was like over 1,000. Maybe I'm wrong, but definitely it seemed like some members of the far right were out. Like in Oregon, there was people doing Nazi salutes and stuff like that. But interestingly enough, if you look at those photos, they're standing right next to several African-American people. So, you know, Berkeley was seemed like the most violent. You know, people clashed in a park in Berkeley, California. But I'm just curious, you know, your initial thoughts, like you brought up. I mean, it's hard to think of a time when, you know, there needs to be demonstrations in support of the president, you know, only several months after they're elected. Everybody's had similar thoughts. I mean, the only thing I can think about in my memory of something somewhat similar is support rallies for maybe the first Gulf War or something along those lines, but nothing as far as just like the head of the state is legitimate. I mean, that seems to be the main focus of these demonstrations. And not only is he legitimate, the protests against him are not legitimate. They're not legitimate because they're some seditious force that's acting with outside agents like, I don't know, the Muslim Brotherhood or, you know, whatever comes out of CPAC this week as far as conspiracy theories. And moreover, that like these people are paid protesters. They're not legitimate. They don't want to do this. They're just doing it to get money, so on and so forth. So your initial thoughts on March for Trump, and what does it say about this kind of evolving so-called deplorable subculture of Trump supporters?
I think it shows both sort of desperation and emboldenedness in some ways. That, you know, on one hand, I think there is a definite crisis of legitimacy with Trump's presidency, that, you know, people feel the need to say that, like, you know, he is a legitimate president. People voted for him. People still support him. Even if their efforts at doing that seem almost half-hearted in some ways. On the other hand, you know, the fact that, you know, some of these protests have had, you know, larger numbers of more fascistic elements than I think your run-of-the-mill Trump supporter shows. You know, that I think the sort of fascist arms of the right are a little bit more emboldened and see more interplay and access with the mainstream. And, you know, if the only people, you know, showing out to these protests, you know, get perceived or seen as, you know, the sort of fascist wing, you know, I think that has the tendency to pull some of Trump's support further and further to the right and further towards fascism in some ways. I will say that, you know, some of the other protests seemed, you know, a little bit more benign. I know the one in Houston that took place, it happened out in the suburbs. There is at most 100 people there at the largest point. And the crowd was actually, you know, surprisingly diverse from what you often conceptualize a Trump rally being. That, you know, I'd say probably a fourth of the crowd there was people of color. And it seemed that at least a couple of the key organizers were people of color. And so I think that, you know, complicates some of our narratives and demands a bit more of a rigorous analysis of exactly what's going on with this phenomenon and, you know, sort of, you know, it resists the sort of binary, simplistic characterization that is often very tempting to use. But I think, you know, but the other side of it is that, like, you know, throughout Trump's candidacy, throughout his presidency, there's always been these debates about, you know, whether or not Trump is an actual fascist. And I think you know, I think that debate is in some ways a little bit academic and also a little bit useful in some ways. But one of the critiques that I've seen from a couple places is that, you know, Trump has not really ever tried to, how should I say it, create an autonomous or independent sort of grassroots or paramilitary support structure around him. That, like, it's all, like, in a lot of ways his candidacy was a very traditional candidacy in terms of, you know, this is the campaign, this is what the campaign is. You know, at occasional rallies you'll have Trump supporters punching or kicking or pushing people, but, you know, for the most part, it was a fairly traditional campaign. The difference was sort of the rhetoric and the substance of what the campaign was putting forth. But what these rallies, you know, could start to look like potentially is, you know, a more sort of grassroots repressive force that's independent of the state. You know, what happens when, you know, we saw a couple of the Trump supporters at the Berkeley rally that, you know, showed up in helmets and gas masks and had clubs and shields. You know, if these rallies start getting more militant, we could see that, you know, these become a more autonomous sort of grassroots auxiliary to the state security apparatus. And, you know,
well, let's talk about that real quick, because, for instance, you know, we got a there's an article that just came out today from Salon, and one of the interview questions they initially sent us in the interview questions they sent, which I thought was actually really good. They ended up not printing it or the answer, but thought it raised an interesting point. They said, based on the popularity of, you know, this guy called, they're calling Based Stickman, which is some guy that came in a hoodie and a gas mask and he had a stick and, you know, he's ready to fight essentially. And he's really popular on, you know, the alt-right boards and different stuff like that. And also like Trump supporters and stuff like that. They're all sharing this meme. But he brought up, he's like, what would you say to people that would say, like, by going out and fighting these people, you're giving them what they want? Because all they want is to basically focus on fighting you. So, you know, would it make more sense to just, like, let them have, like, a shitty rally with 50 people? What would you say to that?
You know, my general response is that's sort of bullshit. the reason that we're in this mess is because, you know, people have been ignoring fascism, the alt-right, Trump's candidacy for a long time. You know, if Donald Trump's first three, you know, campaign rallies almost 2 years ago had just gotten shut down, you know, would we be in a different spot? Who knows? You know, it's definitely easier to fight back against these things before they have momentum. And, you know, but, you know, taking Milo Yiannopoulos as sort of one example, you know, he wasn't born yesterday. You know, by the time the media starts paying any attention to him, you know, he already had his book deal. He already had millions of followers on social media. He was already, you know, a rich fascist bigot that was accustomed to making the rounds on the college speaking circuit. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that has, you know, changed since then is that, you know, people started fighting back. People started taking this as a serious threat, as somebody that's, you know, basically makes their living touring the country advocating violence against certain individuals and communities. And people, you know, are like, we're not gonna put up with that anymore. We're not gonna give that a free pass. You know, the whole of recent history tells us that, you know, ignoring fascism has never, ever made it go away. And so, you know, is that to say that we have to counter-protest every single one of their right-wing rallies when they're, you know, doing a good job of discrediting themselves? You know, not necessarily. You know, if I think that's something that, you know, we should be handling on a case-by-case basis, that, you know, if there's a situation where, you know, they're in a point of weakness and we're not in a position to organize something effective, then, like, you know, maybe it's better to just let them sort of fumble around and look like idiots. But on the other hand, you know, that has to be part of a larger strategy that's like, you know, we're gathering forces, we are, you know, gathering intel, we're doing something as part of a longer term strategy to, you know, to prevent this from growing. Because if you just ignore all of them, you know, they find, you know, they find what, you know, they find the comfort that they need and the space that they need to organize, recruit, build, radicalize, all those things.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, and I do agree with you, of course, but I think a lot of people would say is the one thing that unites all these various people, and there's so many different currents within this thing. I mean, if you look at the Berkeley thing, the stuff that I've read and I've seen is that most of them are, you know, weird anarcho-capitalist, libertarian people, like somewhat alt-right, definitely like in that camp, you know, either that or just, you know, kind of deplorable Trump supporters. So there's like a weird mix. There's no like ideological current. But definitely what unites them is the idea that the left, anarchist, anti-fascist, social movements for liberatory social change that are, you know, pushing against, you know, the regime are the one key thing that can unite them in their desire to fight them. So I don't know if you just have any ideas about that.
There's a kernel of truth there that, like, when you're, you know, feeling attacked, feeling under siege, you try and, you know, it can tend to push people towards these sort of united front positions and, you know, make some strange bedfellows out of, you know, what otherwise might be ideological opponents. The flip side of that, though, is that, you know, having all these sort of fissures and contradictions in their movement, I think makes them vulnerable to, you know, various pressures. And, you know, the same way that, you know, our fissures and disagreements can sometimes really flare up and come to the surface when we're being targeted by the state or by fascism, you know, I think the same thing is true with their movements, that, you know, when something goes wrong for them, they you know, they have their own witch hunts looking for, you know, an internal explanation for where they went wrong. And I think, you know, we've seen some of that with the doxing that has taken place, where, you know, various fascist personalities have been outed and publicized and had their personal information sort of put out to the world. And, you know, and then, you know, in the follow up of that, you know, some of those people, you know, retreat pretty quickly. You know, the movements start fighting with each other about, you know, do this person's personal, you know, does this person's personal life live up to, you know, our ideology, or, you know, are they hypocrites? Whose fault is it that this doxing took place? All sorts of things come out. And so I think a lot of that, you know, is really really beneficial in neutralizing the effectiveness of you know, various strands of fascism and right-wing reactionary stuff.
Yeah, I would say one thing that's very clear is that, you know, the hardline rules of the alt-right are definitely shifting, and that definitely there's more people that want to get in bed with them that, you know, maybe people of color, maybe, you know, queer or whatever. I mean, something that before, you know, would have been kind of inconceivable. Now there definitely seems to be a lot of overlap with a lot of other right-wing ideas.
Right.
Which I think for them, they're excited about because they get more people looking at them. But at the same time, I think they're also kind of worried about their ideas becoming muddled or whatever. But at the same time, for us, I think, you know, the kind of weird mutant mix that comes out of that is actually much more scary than perhaps the alt-right was to begin with. I mean, I think definitely like what we saw in Berkeley, I mean, you know, if that's what people want to do, I mean, that to me is much more scary than Identity Europa.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could switch gears real quick, I mean, I know in the last interview we were kind of asking about, like, what do you see the far right doing under Trump? And now that we've had some time and we've seen not necessarily groups, obviously, you know, taking credit for these types of vandalism and arson attacks and outright murders. But I'm just curious if you had any thoughts about just like how their side has played out under Trump so far. We know that, like, for instance, like the TWP was saying stuff like, oh, it would have been way better if Hillary won because we would have had a uniting force to, you know, bring people together. I know they're doing a big rally next month in Kentucky. But just how do you think the far right, the alternative right, white nationalists have really done under Trump? How have they kind of responded to the regime?
I think in a lot of ways it's still, you know, a little bit too early to tell. Mm-hmm. I think there have been, you know, several pretty significant defeats for them. The first one on Inauguration Day when Richard Spencer got punched. you know, I still see that meme popping up. You know, a month and a half later, mm-hmm. and, you know, even the New York Times was, you know, posing the question of, like, you know, is it okay to punch Nazis? So I think, you know, I think that was a pretty big humiliation and setback for them. You know, I think Milo has been, you know, relatively sunk after his Berkeley rally was shut down by protests and you know, anarchists. It was actually a right-wing group that, you know, outed him for making these comments regarding you know, pedophilia or, mm-hmm. you know, sexual activity with minors. And, you know, it's a little bit, you know, distressing that, like, you know, you have somebody that's sort of traveling the country advocating various levels of genocide, and then it's, you know, one sort of offhand comment about, you know, sleeping with teenagers that really does his career in for him.
Right.
But, you know, he's had to resign from Breitbart. His book deal got canceled. You know, things that, you know, tend to mark the, at least for the time being, the end of his career. But, you know, then on the other hand, you know, we've seen some other things. You know, TWP is still organizing. They're planning this rally in Kentucky. These pro-Trump rallies have, you know, given fascists, you know, additional opportunities to sort of cross-pollinate and have FaceTime with, you know, sort of rank and file Trump supporters without them having to organize the rally themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just the fact that, you know, some of these fascists have a voice in the White House now. And so, you know, do you need to have a a rally on the steps of, you know, whatever state capital and risk getting beat up by Antifa if you can make a few phone calls and get in touch with Steve Bannon.
Well, so, but I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the reality that's at play. I don't think they have a line to Steve Bannon. You know, I think that I think what's interesting to them with them is that essentially I think they're being played just like a lot of radical movements get played by liberals. They're being mined for talking points, for ideas. I mean, they put somebody from FAIR into the Border and Customs Agency. You know, like one of Richard Spencer's former friends from Duke University is now like a top aide at the White House. You know, there's other people that are like somewhat associated with the alt-right. So there's that. But I mean, they're not going to get what they want, which is a, you know, an all-white ethno state. I see them being used and like thrown away. And like even people close to Bannon have said like, yeah, he's not with that, but he's using them to, you know, to ride a wave just like Milo was, you know. So, I mean, I think that's an interesting conundrum for them. I think it sucks for us because that means their ideas get like somewhat normalized, albeit watered down. It's definitely going to give them more room to maneuver, but I think ultimately it'll probably hurt them and they'll have to reinvent themselves again at some point. You know, we're not alt-right. We're, you know, whatever. We're something else.
Whatever the new catchphrase is, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, and the other angle on that is that, you know, people that are getting used and getting played, you know, at some point, you know, they're gonna, you know, have to bite that bitter truth. And, you know, the history of the right is that they tend to lash out rather violently about that. And so, you know, and that could be, you know, at the left, it could be at the administration, it could be at, you know, migrant communities. But once they feel cast out and marginalized again, and in some ways, you know, that's almost more dangerous in the short term in terms of their reaction. And, you know, especially after a period in which they've sort of been building and growing their base. That's a lot more people that, you know, they have to tap into with that sort of anger and backlash.
Cause, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but the Traditional Worker Party has this video for the Kentucky rally. It almost looks like an Allegra commercial, like, you know, somebody talking about ear symptoms. And then like, there's this new thing called National Socialism. And it's, but I mean, their whole shtick now is like, you know, we're not the Democrats and we're not the Republicans. We're fighting for you. So, I mean, they've had to do like almost a complete 360 and be like, actually, Trump isn't that great. And, you know, we're actually the solution, which I think is an interesting dynamic, too, because they've been painted as so like, you know, an auxiliary to the Trump administration. You know, now as Trump really comes out as like, you know, really this force that's like, you know, deregulating everything, slashing taxes, you know, rolling back reforms, you know, in place, you know, on the banking industry that make sure that, you know, we maybe won't go into another economic crisis. I mean, all this stuff that, you know, is going to end up really fucking over working people. Like, you know, I know that none of them are really excited about the fact that the Republicans want to take away the Affordable Care Act and replace it with some like even worse plan that's going to like screw over so many people and is going to, you know, leave so many people not only without cheap or free medical care, but it's going to essentially tax them again for being poor, which is the main thing that sucked about the ACA. So I think for them, they're in a weird position where they really back this bourgeois politician that like, you know, talks a populist game, but really when you get down to it, it's just another version of neoliberal, you know, pro-billionaire bullshit. And they've really got to decide now, okay, actually, you know, what are we about now that this ride was over? And I think that's why they really wanted Trump to lose, is because they wouldn't have to answer any of that. You know, they could just be the weird renegades that were crazy. And I don't know. Like, I just watched an interview with Richard Spencer on Vice. I don't know if you've seen it, where he's outside and he's like in the Washington Monument, and he makes this he makes this point to the person he's being interviewed by. He said, like, people want to talk about us because we're dangerous. You know, we have dangerous ideas. It's like, dude, you want to, like, bring back the Confederacy. Like, how dangerous are you? Like, what in your ideas actually, like, or, you know, bring back the Roman Empire? Like, how dangerous of an idea is that? Like, who benefited from like, that superstructure in your idea beyond, like, you know, a handful of ruling elites, you know? So
right. I definitely think that in some ways that, you know, Trump's victory has thrown the right and even the Republican Party into a sort of crisis, and that, you know, it's clear that the mainstream sort of Republican establishment is stuck in this position where they feel like they have to use Trump, but aren't really completely on board with Trump.
Right.
And you know, this sort of strange coalition between all these different sectors of the right that have, in a lot of ways, very, very divergent interests, but each seem to be using each other for their own sort of game plan. And so it's interesting to think about how all that will shake out, and, like, if there's a point at which, you know, even the Republican establishment gets sort of fed up with how Trump and Bannon are running things and want a more sort of politics as usual approach to their policies.
Or there's just like a new order that's established, and it's just like this really, you know, corporate, you know, suck up all the energy we can. Because I mean, I actually believe Bannon when he says, like, you know, a new political order is being formed, and he's speaking to this kind of rise in, like, populist nationalist you know, parties around the world, which obviously includes fascist parties. But I mean,
right,
I think that he is right, and I think but at the same time, like, that doesn't mean much at all. I mean, we've seen, you know, new regimes come into power all the time, and, like, there's a new ruling class that's, like, solidified, you know, within a couple months, and, like, they, you know, they have a new set of elites that set policy, and it, like, it sticks to that. I mean, it could very well be that they're, you know, the old kind of, like, neoliberal Republicans could be pushed aside, and we could have a new set in place, but, you know, wouldn't mean much at all. It could just be, like, a new set of oligarchs. Yeah.
Sort of the death throes of empire and decline, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's switch gears one more time. You know, just in closing, I mean, do you have any thoughts? I mean, it's a weird ass time. You know, there's so much going on. You know, when we talked to Peter Gelderlos a couple weeks ago, you know, one of the things that he said that kind of stuck with me, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but he said, like, we need to kind of resist this kind of, like, activist-y urge to, like, you know, constantly be in, like, this hyper, the world is on fire all around us all the time, and we really have to kind of think and sit down, like, strategically and really kind of build in congruence with, like, the strategy that we have. And I'm just kind of curious, like, how you would think about it. I would see it like, yeah, that's great, but also at the same time, like, the world kind of is on fire, and, like, all this crazy shit is happening. So how do you kind of bridge those two things with, like, this constant, like, feeling of urgency, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of people are just like, there's so much happening that I don't even know where to start. Because I think that's the other main question, I think, for that projects like It's Going Down and others are trying to answer, is like, okay, there's all these people that are excited, but how do we bring them in? And we talked about this last time too, but, you know, how do we bring all these people up to speed in a relatively short time, but also give them something to do and plug them in some way in a movement that is, like, based around, you know, affinity and trusting people over time and all that stuff.
I mean, you've sort of articulated the two different poles pretty well right there, that, like, you know, we do need to be patient and thoughtful and strategic and deliberate about, you know, how we're doing all these things, and, you know, what we're planning and what we're organizing. at the same time, there is, you know, what I feel, and I think what a lot of people feel, is a sort of limited window in which to sort of disrupt the regime and disrupt their consolidation of power before before that window closes and power consolidates, and then we're sort of, you know, stuck with everything and sort of stuck reacting. I don't know, and I don't know what the exact answer to that is. I think, you know, on sort of a personal level, I think it's really difficult to not just feel really overwhelmed about it. I talked to a little while ago about the sort of the paralysis that comes with the fear of repression and the fear generated by repression. I think the other, you know, the other form of paralysis that we deal with is just this sort of really overwhelmed feeling about how much there is to do and how urgent all of it feels. And, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, we're all, you know, we're each just sort of one human being and, you know, we're each just sort of one organization and, you know, one community and things of that sort. And so there's a limit to what we can do. And I think we have to pace ourselves and be realistic in our expectations of both for ourselves and for the people around us, because otherwise, you know, we'll all be used up and burned out in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not something that we want either. Like, this is going to be a struggle. It's not going to be over in 6 months. And, you know, we need to, you know, be building capacity but also, you know, pacing ourselves and taking care of ourselves and, you know, being gentle and forgiving with ourselves, so that, you know, we're still around and we're still strong and we're still healthy, and we still like each other in 6 months.
Yeah.
Have to like all of each other, but we have to like some of each other. So, and we have to be able to, you know, at least have civil and working relationships, even with the people that we don't necessarily like. So, you know, I sort of agree with Peter's assessment for the most part, but I think there is a risk in being a little bit too complacent and not paying attention and thinking that we can sort of chart our own course without being perceptive to what's happening around us, because otherwise we'll, you know, still be in the slowly building stage when you know that window closes.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, we talked in another conversation, but you know, there was a slogan that the German communists, I believe, used when the Nazis were in power. They said, "After Hitler, us," and they were referring to the fact that, like, you know, like, well, the Nazis suck now, but you know, he'll pass after a while, and then we'll be in charge, you know. And I feel like, you know, history may not afford us that luxury. You know, we need to think about the fact that, yeah, maybe there are people that actually don't want us around for the long haul. And, you know, I talk to a lot of older, you know, socialists and communists and revolutionaries, and I feel like that's kind of their how they see the world, that, like, you know, there'll always be a tomorrow. You know, like, you know, history is just this ever unfolding thing in front of us, and we'll always have another shot. And it's like, you know, it's just the way the ecological and economic and political situation is playing out. You know, we may actually have limited time.
Right. And, you know, I think, I mean, there is sort of some distinction to be drawn with the German communists, that, you know, in some ways they were sort of tacitly complacent with the rise of Nazism and subverting the resistance to it under the presumption that, you know, their time would follow. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, you know, I haven't seen too many people that are saying that we shouldn't resist the Trump regime or trying to subvert the resistance on the grounds that, you know, they will be the next ones to power. And I think that would be, you know, grossly arrogant of pretty much any left formation to think that we're in any position to, you know, succeed the Trump regime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from a larger perspective, you know, there is always tomorrow. It's the question, though, is, you know, how much harm and how much damage takes place in the interim. You know, there's resistance movements in Germany again today, but a lot of people, you know, we had, you know, a lot of people died in between. You know, a lot of movements were crushed, and, you know, the fact that three generations from now there might be another resistance movement in the United States doesn't give me a whole lot of hope. If we have to live through, you know, a decade of full-blown fascism or totalitarianism in the meantime. So, you know, I think it is important to remember the future and keep things in perspective, but also not get lulled into complacency by it. Because, you know, I think complacency tends to be the downfall of the opposition a lot of times.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Well, on that note, let's just end by plugging this tour. You guys are going all over. You want to just talk a little bit about when it starts, how long it's going to go, where you're going to go, where people can go to get more information, all that good stuff.
So a lot of some of the logistics are still being worked out, but it sounds like we're starting in Minneapolis on April 2nd. With an event there, and then sort of heading south and west from there, through the Dakotas, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and then over the West Coast, to LA, and basically up the entire West Coast, the Bay Area, Oregon, and ending in Seattle, sometime around the end of April. I am not the best person to give more information, about the logistics and where to find more information than that. Hopefully you can get that from Josie.
Sure. Yeah. We'll definitely have that on the post. There is a post on It's Going Down. You can get more information. You're also going to be going to some Native reservations, which is exciting. You're going to be talking about the grand juries that are convening around Standing Rock, trying to get people for engaging in actions there, and talking about moving defense. And I think it's great y'all are doing that. I think it's much needed. You know, it was great last year. We had like three or four tours going around at the time, and I feel like there needs to be that right now. Just like,
right,
you know, people kind of like hitting the road and like talking to other people, what's happening. You know, I really think that kind of activity right now, especially like when people are kind of like feeling out how it's all going to go down, I think it's really needed right now. But anyway, James, thanks so much for coming on once again, and thanks for adding your thoughts. Anything else you want to say? Any shout outs?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for joining us, and be sure to check out the tour if you can.
All right, you made it all the way to the very end. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate everybody that's been listening, leaving comments on our iTunes page. Remember, you can subscribe to the It's Going Down podcast on iTunes. I don't actually know how that works because I never actually use iTunes myself. But if you do, you can actually sign up to use that iTunes page and it will come right to you, or so I've been told by people that do use that program. You can also sign up to give us a good rating and, hey, leave a comment. Tell us what your favorite podcast is. And remember, if you want to come on this show, all you got to do is email us, info@itsgoingdown.org. Check us out. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want to hear. Who do you want to be on? Is there an author or a group or a crew out there that's doing something that's great that everybody needs to know about? Let us know. We want to hear about it. We want to have the most cutting edge, cool shit on here as we can. And we want to know what's actually going down, whether it's in a trailer park or reservation, in a big city or a small town, it does not matter. Get at us every single day. We're busting it out. Please, if you can, go to itsgoingdown.org. Click the donate button. Help us grow. Help us continue. And remember, if you want to hear more podcasts, if you want to see more original analysis every single day, go to itsgoingdown.org. Be sure to check out the interview we did with James only a couple months ago. It's really interesting to look back and see the comparisons between what we were talking about just as Trump was coming in and to now. So, hey, let us know what you're thinking. What's your thoughts? What's going on in your head? Until next time, we'll be here. We know you will be. Let's keep moving forward together. Thanks a lot.